we go. Tom, right there. You where you are, you know who you are. You're right, just at MyNorthWest.com. Text as well at 98973. Come on in through the state roofing text line. We are all ready to have it. Protests broke out last night in Minneapolis again. A 22-year-old man pulled over by the police. Apparently, he had it expired tags, and they also said something about the rearview mirror had a air freshener hanging from it or something. They get the guy, they pull him out of the car, or he gets out of the car voluntarily. They also find out that he's got a warrant for his arrest because I think it was about, was it in June of 2020, he had a gun and had fled police then. If the video has now been released, which is pretty fast, don't you think, Tom? I guess they try to get it out there as quickly as possible so people see it. And you see the one male cop has got the guy, the 22-year-old, against the car, and he's getting his right hand to come back. It looks like he's struggling a little bit with his handcuffs, the policeman is. So the female police officer comes forward. She places her left hand on and around the elbow of the 22-year-old. And at that point, I think the policeman, the larger guy, lets go. And I think at that point, this guy who's run from the police before decides, I'm doing it again. I do not want to go to jail for a weapons charge and fleeing police with the warrant that's out, gets in his car. And that's the resisting the arrest, get in the car. And at that point, we have the sound of So now what you have is, what you'll hear is, we just played this in the national news, just had this for you as well. So you can hear a little bit of the beginning of it, the body camera of the shooting of the young man by the police officer who was struggling to get control. You can barely hear, she goes, he's got a warrant. Okay. So they know that he has a warrant out for his arrest. They also know about the gun. So I'm assuming they're treating this guy cautiously, as they probably would all. At that point, he's resisting arrest. He's sort of struggling to get back into the car again. And then you hear the female officer yell out, I'll tase you. And is per the training, that the gun weighs about 34 ounces. A taser weighs about 8. The taser is normally in your weaker hand, so you're right. If you're right-handed, you're going to, on your holster will be your right hand. As you pull that gun out, you'll know that is about 34 pounds in my hand. I've got this gun. It's in my right side. Police often will wear on their left side their weaker hand, their taser, and as you pull that out, it's about 8 ounces. So there's a difference. You feel it. She says, I'll tase you. She's got her police weapon in her hand, and you can hear taser, taser. They say taser, taser, taser 3 times to let her partner know that she's about to tase the guy so he doesn't step in front and get tased as well. So she's following along with that. And that
oh, wow.
Discharges the weapon once. The guy gets in the car, drives a short distance. His girlfriend or whatever is in the car with him, partner's in the car with him. He then crashes into another car, and I assume at that point he is about to die or has already passed, and they take him to the hospital, and there we go. Have I missed anything on that one?
Just one slight correction. He was 20, not 22, 20. Okay. And the warrant was for a missed court appearance. The court appearance was for 2 misdemeanor charges, one of carrying a pistol without a permit, and the other one is that he ran away from officers last June. But no, otherwise, I think that's exactly right. Now, there's some question, was it an accident or not? The police chief seems to think that based on what we saw and the officer's reaction right after she discharged a weapon, that it was an accident, that she acted like it's been, oh my God, I shot him. And so he's calling it an accident. I think that there, if you want to put a negative spin on it, you could say, well, that's an easy excuse or justification for killing somebody. But I think it seems like if she's yelling taser, taser, that she thought that she was going to tase him. I can't imagine in that circumstance where you would be so duplicitous that you would say, okay, I'm going to say this and do that. So I just think, again, a common sense attitude toward that was it was an accident. Now, that's why I thought it was. I asked you earlier, John, with all of your police context, doesn't a cop know the difference between holding a gun and holding a taser? I don't know what the difference is. That is interesting. If there's that big a discrepancy, what could she have been thinking to think that that taser wasn't a taser but a gun if it's more than four times as heavy? Now, let's assume that it is an accident.
I'll assume this, Tom. Here we have somebody who has already gotten away from police one other time, and they also know there's a warrant out for his arrest, and they also know that he had a gun. That's what they know. Hold on. That's what they
know. I don't know.
They also know he's getting back into his...
Yes.
Well, if there's a warrant out for his arrest, they'll know what the arrest was for. They'll know fleeing police, and they also know about gun, because that's how it's public. So when they called him in, that's what they got on the guy. There's a warrant for him. As he's getting back in his car, very, very, very dangerous situation.
Okay.
Very dangerous situation for these police. When the person's going back into their car, what are they going back into the car to get?
Okay.
Are they getting – so they're, he's obviously struggling to get away. He's getting back into his car. So now she's going to tase him in order to try to control this person. It's very scary. So she taser, and shoots him with a gun instead of the taser. I think this has happened before in the news a couple of years ago. We might have covered something like this. And this is this is what happens, right? So these are human beings in a highly stressful situation.
I know.
And she shoots him instead of tases him.
But she's in. Okay, so that's that. I assume that no one thinks that tasing him at that point is a mistake. But shooting him is a mistake.
Yes.
And so it seems to me, as good-hearted as we can imagine this cop being, as with all the right motivations and everything else, you can't afford to make this kind of mistake in that profession. It's like an airline, pilot who can't crash the plane. That even if she didn't plan on what she was doing, this seems to me like a fireable offense. You've killed somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, it was a mistake and you didn't intend it, but it's fireable, correct?
Yeah, right. Well, listen, the point of it is she could have shot him, right? In most cases, what you'll do is you'll hear the officer go, gun, 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 right? They'll yell out, gun, gun. So that one of them has seen a gun, and then it's like, then they shoot him, right?
She
doesn't see the gun. You don't see that. They see his hands, tase him to control him, which is what she's trying to do. He's resisting arrest. And then at that point, you resist arrest, a whole lot of bad crap can happen.
But not
Eric Gardner. George Floyd, right?
Yeah.
The poor guy that was in the Wendy's parking lot down there in Atlanta, same thing. Mm-hmm. Once it becomes this sort of free-for-all of where I'm struggling with you and you're trying to get away and I'm trying to stop you and who knows what happens next, then bad, bad, bad things. You're taking it up to a whole other level.
Yes.
There was the story in Minneapolis where the woman complains about something happening outside. The two cops show up to her door or outside in that parking lot, and the officer gets scared thinking that she's made an abrupt noise or something. Remember that story? And then he fires at her from his police car, from the passenger side of the car, strikes and kills the woman. He, I think, was in for third degree. It might be manslaughter, and that's one of the cases from Minneapolis from a couple years ago. Do you remember that story?
Not specifically. I'm not denying it. I don't remember that specifically.
Okay.
But yes, the problem is that these kinds of things can't happen. And I couldn't tell when you're saying, well, it was an accident, if that's like, well, accidents happen. But accidents can't be allowed to happen with such fatal consequences. The question is, will there be more to come? I'm assuming there'll be a civil suit. The city may have to. This is in Minneapolis, by the way. It's a suburb of Minneapolis, about a 10-minute drive away, I think, from the trial in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. But, God, just awful. Which then leads perfectly into our next case, unless you
have done. No, we got it right here. So,
about another guy.
This is like, another
okay,
guy.
Go ahead.
This is in Virginia. Yes. And let's keep in mind, police make 35 million traffic stops a year. In this case, the guy's driving, the back window is tinted, and I think they can't see. There's no license plate, but he's just previously bought the thing, so he's got one of those temporary tags. He doesn't find a safe place to pull over, so he drives about a mile with his blinker on.
Open the door slowly and get out! Get out of the car, now! Open the door, get out of the car!
Both officers have weapons drawn. They don't know why the guy drove for a mile and a half. He pulls over. He stops. He doesn't get out. He's got you can see his hands, and they continue to tell him to get out of the car.
Keep your hands outside the window. Keep your hands outside the window. Get out of the car now.
Get out of the car.
Now. Get out of the car now. Yo, what? Guess what? I'm a veteran, too. I learned to obey. Get out of the car.
What's going on?
Get out of the car now!
What's going on?
What's going on? You're fixing to ride the lightning, son.
I'm sorry.
Get out of the car now!
All right. The one cop yelling, get out of the car now, fixing to ride the lightning. People say, oh, that means he's going to try to kill him. Other people said, no, that means taser. In this case, he then pulls out because the guy still won't get out of the car. They reach in, try to grab his hand and get him out. He then sprays him in the face with mace, and then they finally get him out of the car. They're wrestling back and forth. He wants to know why he's being stopped, and they're going to get him for resisting arrest or – Well,
he gives himself up. He does not get out of the car. He refuses to get out of the car.
Does he lay down on the ground, or they push him down on the ground?
Yes.
And then he won't go down. So the guy tries to move and kick out the back of his knee. Right.
Yeah.
And then finally they get him down onto the ground. And now the cop that shot the guy with the mace in the face ends up losing his job. Right.
Yes. But not
he gets fired immediately.
This is different from what we just talked about in that. This happened a few weeks ago, and there was a police investigation. This guy who was pulled from the car, he's a active duty lieutenant, I think. He has just filed suit, but in the course of the investigation, the police determined that the cop who sprayed him with pepper spray, was not, following policy, and so he has been fired. The frustration that the cop felt about him not getting out of the car. I mean, they're stopped in a well-lit place at a gas station, which is where the guy, drove intentionally. Mm-hmm. And was just saying, what have I done? I haven't done anything. And he says, just get out of the car. And he says, no, tell me what I'm doing. So he did not follow directions. And the sense is, because I watched the whole five minute, 50 second thing. It looked to me like the cop who had the gun pulled on him, but then he shot him with pepper spray. I think he just got frustrated. Like after 4 minutes of this, to heck with you, and he sprays him, and that's where he made the mistake. He should not have done that. And then they ended up letting him go. There was for no good reason that they pulled him over.
Yeah.
But again, you never know, and so that's why the cops reacted the way they did. And he admitted, the guy in the car said, "I'm scared to get out. I don't try. I got two, guns pulled on me. I don't feel safe with you guys." So he didn't want to get out. Anyway, that thing was resolved. So that's our second example of a traffic stop gone differently than the first one. And now we have a third one that's even.
Well, I would say that from what I know from talking to cops and you've watched this sort of stuff and they're trained on this, the less compliant the person is. In that case, you assume something's going wrong. Like, why a mile and a half down the road? Why not pull over? Yeah. What is going on inside that car which you can't see through the window? So they're assuming something is wrong. Something's not right. Your adrenaline level gets up. And then all of a sudden, that's when stuff can start to happen. In this case, 38-year-old officer has been serving in the state police since 2015. Three children and one on the way.
So I run my checks and I can talk to you a little bit while I'm running my checks. And then
this is different.
Right away.
Yeah, this is in New Mexico.
He's talking
to the guy. He's on the passenger side, and the driver is, and I think there's somebody in the passenger side. He's talking to the driver.
I got paperwork I got to do, Hey, real quick. You have a firearm on you? Yeah.
By the way, he has been talking to this guy for about 3 minutes on the side of the road,
right,
trying to get this and that, proof of insurance, registration.
Yeah.
I need you just to sit in my car for just a moment. I'm going to run a check just to make sure things are okay. He's perfectly polite to this guy, and then yep. he notices, hey, do you have a gun? You know,
no, I see it. You mind if I take it off you for my safety? All right, hold on.
At this point, the driver begins to get out of the car. The police officer still on the other side, the passenger side, and begins to walk around back to the back of the car. Right. And the guy gets out of the car with the gun. And then he is now on one side. Officer, yeah, it's an AR-15.
All right, let's go to my vehicle, okay? Come on.
The guy that shoots him, it shoots him, I think, 4 or 5 times, then goes over and shoots him point blank and ends his life. So that's the father of three with one more on the way on the side of the road, killed in cold blood. So that's what happens on these traffic stops, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a great illustration. If you watch the whole thing, again, it's about another 5.5 minutes. It's friendly. The conversation goes back and forth. There's no sense of anything going on. It was a stunner to be watching it. I even knew what was going to happen, and I couldn't believe it. When the guy, he just gets out of the car very calmly and then, you know, raises the rifle and just starts, you know, shooting him. It's like completely unexpected, and it cost the cop his life. Yes.
Hmm. We'll see
they
what
did
happens
catch up with the guy
Minneapolis.
Later, just so you know. It was a big shootout with like 3 or 4 other cops, and he was killed, but yeah.
Tonight, I don't know, it's a state of emergency again in Minneapolis for the peaceful protests that will burn and loot.
Yes. I'm not sure. I don't know that it might be in Brooklyn Center where that shooting was, not Minneapolis. I'm not sure in that, though. Don't quote me. We'll have to double check that. But I think
not
there's a curfew
you, all right.
in Brooklyn Center.
Tracy Taylor? Alrighty, thanks, Keel Mortgage, Laura Keel, and everybody there at Keel Mortgage for trusting the Tom and Curley Show to get out the good word that you are the ones to call when it comes to mortgage refinancing. If you want to be able to get a reverse mortgage, it might be right for you. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. The email went out, Tom, from the chorus there at Mount Vernon Presbyterian Church. Quote, I plan on being there this Tuesday, March 10th. Hoping many of you will be there as well. This is from the music director. He had said the stresses and strains and concerns about the virus, but he felt that everybody was going to be on their best behavior when you walked in the door there at the church for the rehearsal that was going to be taking place. It was just going to be a 2-hour rehearsal. I think 60 showed up altogether. They had hand sanitizer. Somebody had brought some oranges or some tangerines, and they were cut up and placed on the side. But people avoided hugging one another. Although it's a huggy church, often described that way. And they didn't share sheet music. They did everything that they were supposed to do according to what was out there at the time. And then after a 2.5-hour practice, everybody knows the story of what had happened next. I think it was 45 members of that chorus had come down with it. I think it was 3 that were hospitalized and 2 that lost their life. The New York Times put a very long piece together walking us through not only the rehearsal and then the aftermath and then where the chorus was in the months following that. Am I missing anything to the lead up on that, Tom?
No, I think that's about right. The key is that this rehearsal like happened the day before. The governor announced that groups of 250 and more should not get together. So even in this choir had 120 people in it, and only about half of them showed up at this particular rehearsal. It was It wasn't like a mandatory rehearsal. So they had only half them. Well, even by those, by the governor's the next day standards, they would have been okay. Because at this time, the hunch was that it was tactile, that you had to touch somebody or touch a surface that had been touched. And so they were playing by the rules that they understood it. The aerosol nature of the of COVID-19 was not obvious. In fact, I think it was around this time when Redfield from the CDC said that he didn't, at this point, he didn't think masks were necessary as long as you washed your hands all the time and didn't touch things that other people were touching. So this was in the very, very early stages of this disease.
It was the World Health Organization that had basically downplayed any of the chances of transmission. They said that the respiratory droplets would need to be large. The person would have to sneeze or cough in front of you. I thought the most sort of telling and sort of sad part of this was the fact that the music director and some other people were then being blamed later on for coming together and singing, and then this for Adam Burdick, is that, I believe, his name?
Yeah.
What he had to suffer from, he didn't know any more than anyone else knew. And the fact that they all came together, and then how later on they were then being described as a super spreader.
Yes. Well, the thing is, there's little denial that they were a super spreading event. However, the thrust of this article, it starts off, and he primarily, you can't blame individual choir members, but he, as the director, was, you know, was really... downplay. I mean, they hit him hard, downtrodden for daring to hold this kind of rehearsal. How dare he? How selfish and all of this. But the thrust of the article was that instead, rather than being condemned, they should be praised. That choir was so forthcoming about what exactly they did, who they did it with, where the groups were, the interactions, that they said that was, they provided so much firsthand, like 65 different people's firsthand information about how they interacted, that it helped establish that, you know, the stuff that it was in the aerosol, it was in the air that the disease was gotten, that they actually did a great thing for the research community by providing so much information. They were not trying to hide it. They weren't in denial and all this. They were saying, oh, my God, whatever. And I think that's the lesson we have to take. In fact, I think the article quotes one of the family members, son or daughter of one of the two poor women who died. One was, I think, 81. The other was 83. That at least they feel like something good came out of their death, because they hope that they had managed to stop so many other choirs. Because choirs, now in retrospect, choirs are seen like they are like the definition of a super spreader event, because everyone's singing. So you're projecting more than you normally would in any other kind of human interaction. So in a lot of ways, they were like the first victims, and helped the rest of us maybe not join them.
It was, yeah, and I think the openness of everyone not trying to cover anything and explained how long, where everybody stood. Right, this is the first group of people that were all together singing. Yep. They said they tried to have 6 feet between them, but in a closed space. They also describe in the article that it was cold that night, but once everyone got in there, the body temperature heated up the room so much so that the heating and cooling system that was there in the church stopped, didn't need it to be on, and then therefore the air became more stagnant, and then that's what you end up with. So I think Nikki was the name of the 83-year-old that ended
Nikki
up going
Hamilton,
to the hospital.
I think.
And I also felt that the article just did such a wonderful job of explaining how important song is.
Yes.
That Adam felt, the music director felt, and everybody else as well, that we need to sing anyway. When I was in school, the nuns used to say to us, why do we sing? We sing because our hearts are so full of joy that words cannot carry our emotions. So that is why we sing. And you really get this feeling that this group, this choir, coming back from the death, they were very, very close to everybody. And they said, well, of course we need to sing. So then they rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and then put what they sort of a Zoom choir of some sort.
Yeah, it was a virtual choir concert. My brother and sister-in-law run a choir, and they did the same kind of thing where they had everybody sing their own parts individually. They were all sent to the director, and then the directors would edit it together with the right, you know, the basses with the basses and the altos and all that. And they ended up putting together this choir concert that they were all really very happy with. And it's so, again, poignant. About half of the members decided they just couldn't do it. They didn't have it in their heart to do it. It put them too close to their grieving of their fellow choir members. Others thought it was just technologically tough. But to me, the one thing that rang the truest, I love this. I've been in, you know, millions of choirs, it feels like, ever since I was you know, like in third or fourth grade. I was in the church choir and the school choir, you know, all the way up through college. And one of the things they said was, it's really difficult for choir members who are used to sitting, you know, in a group with like maybe 10 to 12 other people singing the same note, how powerful you feel like you are just, you're at the front of this engine. They say, but unfortunately,
especially when you have the harmony,
yes,
when you're under it, when that note, and you're on that harmony note, and
yeah,
You feel like you're being lifted up off of the ground. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, completely.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that they said was difficult for the virtuals, everybody had to record themselves solo, and so many of them were stunned and horrified at how wimpy their voices sounded alone, that they needed that communal powerhouse. And it's, that's one of the greatest things about singing. Like, I don't like choral music, just listening to it in the audience, but when you're singing it, because you have you're singing one part, you are aware of all the other like four or five different parts going on at the same time. That is an amazing experience.
Here's a little bit of the music
Sing on.
Yep. Hopefully that's not Sondheim or we are going
to hear. It's close enough to musical theater. I'll take it.
That's all right. Okay, we'll take it. We wrapped it up in a nice story from the New York Times. So I think we got that by the critics. Tracy Terrell, look at traffic for us. Bucky's Auto Service Centers, Sean, does that sound good?
Huh? Sure, why not? Bucky's. Let's get it out of the way.
There you go, Bucky. Not out of the way, just get a chance to sort of roll around in it like a dog on a dead raccoon. Bucky's Auto Service Centers with 16 locations, you can't go wrong. They've got them around for 51 years. That's a lot of rolling around on a dead raccoon. I don't know if they're going to like that spot.
Probably not, but, you know, you did it anyway, so...
Too late now. The wife is furious, Tom. She and he both wanted to save money. That seemed like a good idea. So, and why not at the same time eat healthy? So she sends her husband off to work, and they're saving money because he's not spending it on fast food, and he's going to live a long, healthy life, and both of them achieving exactly what they wanted. Except there's a twist to the story that makes it worthwhile talking about, Tom.
That's right. Guess what? The husband was lying through his teeth. Here's a happy couple. They decide that they want to save up enough money to buy a flat. And they figured out that they're spending, he always ate out for lunch, usually fast food, and he was spending £200 a month. And so they figured that we could save a lot more money if she said, I'll make you these sandwiches. Not only will we be saving money, but we'll also, be giving you a healthier diet. He says, okay, sure.
Let me help. I'm going to make you a sandwich so we can save some money for a flat, and I'm saving £200.
I had to add the British accent, Tom, because... the word flat and pounds might throw some of the listeners off. Yes.
Wow. You picked up on that, John, perfectly. So Thanks, everything's going along hunky-dory for months, and then they made the mistake of having a colleague of the husband's, a friend who work, a co-worker, come and have dinner with them. And in the process, he happens, this friend happens to just mention that, boy, he really was impressed with those sandwiches that she made every day.
I was so impressed with those sandwiches. They were the best that I'd ever had. Archie McBadenstine's makes the best sandwiches anywhere around. They're so healthy.
But he did think that she was charging a little too much, maybe, for it, as good as they were.
Trying to squeeze the pounds out of old man now do you do that, hen?
So, to which the wife then said, what do you mean? I'm not charging anything.
I'm not charging anything. You're slapping him on the back and what, ain't ya?
And it turns out that dastardly husband was selling his wife's sandwich to his friend and taking that money and going to the fast food place and eating King's Ransom every day.
Fish and chips is how they're going to eat that. There's nothing wrong with some fish and chips.
The wife is apoplectic.
Apoplectic! I can't remember my voice. I don't remember which voice I had.
And the husband was unapologetic.
I'm not going to apologize for anything.
I don't owe you an apology. To heck with you. So he ran off with the
priest. Friend. Little meat. Try a little priest.
Yes, that's right. Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd, it turns out.
Oh,
and
right,
Stephen Sondheim came along and wrote a musical about them. Anyway,
Are they okay? Did they get the flat? And what's the happy ending?
Well, no, it sounds like right now she says, well, that's it. I'm refusing to make any more sandwiches. And he says, well, I don't know what you're so angry about. To heck with you. End of story. Curtain.
Well, he was making money on the sandwiches. And then so he was still saving money, right? By buying unhealthy food. Yeah.
That's his argument. But here's the catch. He said, boy, those sandwiches are so good. Why don't you make me two a day? So he was getting her to spend a little more than they should have been spending. Oh, marriage is hard.
Oh, yeah. All right, Tracy Taylor, we'll look at traffic for us.